The Triathlon Show 335. Up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Glenn Polonis. Glenn is a triathlon coach and founder of the PTC High Performance Squad based in Girona, which includes, among others, Martin Van Riel. He is also a Belgian National Federation coach with a home based in Leuven in Flanders. And we'll get into his coaching philosophy, training in a squad, and a bunch of other interesting topics. But before that, let's thank our sponsors. First, we have Precision Fuel and Hydration that have a range of tools and products that you can use to personalize your fueling and hydration strategy. Everyone sweats differently, both in terms of sweat rate and sweat sodium concentration. So you should individualize your hydration strategy, and your fueling strategy will also need to be adapted based on the duration and intensity of exercise or competition, as well as your ability to tolerate certain amounts and types of fuel. You can use the free online sweat test and quick carb calculator on precisionfuelandhydration.com to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs during training and races, and you can book a free one-on-one video consultation with the team to refine your strategy. You can get 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products by using the code TTS22 at checkout on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Roka. Roka produces exceptional quality triathlon wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, performance sunglasses, as well as prescription eyeglasses and sunglasses. Today, I want to highlight Roka's range of eyewear. All of Roka's eyeglasses and sunglasses come with Geeko anti-slip technology, so they never fall off your face. They are extremely lightweight and have unbelievable optics. The performance sunglasses are developed for and tested in up to the most challenging conditions and used in sports ranging from triathlon through speed skating to outdoor and adventure activities. For prescription glasses, there is a home tryout program, and you can also renew your prescription with a simple online vision test at home in front of your computer. All products have multiple options for frame and lens, and they all come with a 2-year warranty. I've tried a number of different Roka eyewear products, and my favorites are the Rory prescription glasses, the Phantom sunglasses for casual day-to-day wear, and the Matador and Matador Air performance sunglasses for active exercise and competition. Visit roka.com/TTS for 20% off your order on all of Roka's products. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Glenn Polonis. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, Glenn. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thanks. Nice to meet you, Michael.
Yeah, it's great to have you. You just told me that you're up in Sierra Nevada currently. How is that going so far?
Well, I just ran to the recording room here, and I have to say you can really feel the thin air, and it's a bit higher than the altitude we're used to, but everything is going well. The athletes are enjoying it. It's a bit more monitoring at this altitude, of course, and taking it easy the first week. But in general, everything is going well.
Good. Yeah. So let's start with just a bit of a deeper introduction. Can you tell us more about yourself, your history in the sport and in general, and what you're doing now, what you're up to with the squad and so on?
Okay. Yeah. So my name is Glenn Polonis. I'm actually a development coach for the Belgium National Triathlon Federation. I got the chance to work with the Belgian Hammers as well over the past years, especially during the COVID period. It was been an interesting journey. I really started small. It's building my own squad as a coach. I have a background in cycling, where I used to ride with the professionals, but I had to quit the sports due to an injury, unfortunately. And like it learned me a lot about how to approach training, my own experiences, combined with what I learned at university. So after finishing cycling, I went to university again, studied physiotherapy, where I found myself being more interested more and more into physiology again, and really dive into the science part of training more and more, because I always felt that with my own experience with coaching, I never got most out of my own values and my own physiology. So actually, I really wanted to dive into that, and I started exploring, reading a lot, and got inspired by some good professors in University of Leuven, who really helped me a lot. And yeah, step by step, I started to become more a coach than a physiotherapist. I stopped my job as a physio and started my own squats, first with a team, where you found yourself always limited with like budget problems to do what you really want to do with your athletes. And because I've always wanted to go full in, like completely to get to the highest level, and I always felt like somehow limited. So at one point the athletes were like really telling me as well, maybe we should start our own squad and we find funding within our team and we start training with you. And yeah, that's how PTC started. It started as a joke because the athletes used to call it Polonis training crew. And then yeah, it started like that, and it's steadily grow and became bigger. And I worked for University of Leuven, where I'm a coach of the university team, and the athletes had a perfect environment where we had the infrastructure of the university and also the social part with, you know, like high level athletes combined with a bit more recreational athletes. Was a perfect environment. I was a bit inspired by Leeds University in the UK, how they work. And yeah, that's how the squad started.
So you have, just to help clarify a bit, you have the PTC squad, which is an international squad of elite athletes. And you're normally, now you're in Sierra Nevada, of course, but you're based in Girona normally. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's been a big change. My experience was that, like, I'm always with the young under 23 Belgium guys. They're always time limited, and combination with the studies, it's really hard to get to the elite level. And my experience with the very elites is that they just go all in at one point and they moved abroad. Less stress of the daily environment and better weather conditions as well, if you come from the north, like, you know. So it was really important for me that I embodied as a coach that I'm wanting to make that step to go there, and to show the athletes that it's quite a necessary step to do, to go all in. And so we moved to Girona. It has its challenges because I still have a part of the squad, the young guys who are still in Leuven, Belgium. I have some assistant coaches with who I work, and they do a great job there to help the athletes when I'm not around. It's hard to be at two places at the same time. But I see the squad more and more developing to Girona. And like, for me, what's really like satisfying for me is that I see now young Belgium guys saying, next winter, we're going also to move to Girona and go all in. So that's really one of my mission as a development coach in Belgium as well, to get this kind of mindset. So they can train in a professional environment with the best athletes. And I think it's a win-win for both, to have new young blood in a group with experienced athletes in Girona. I think it's also good to sharpen up them and to realize the passion they show on a daily basis, just enjoying the sports and not get stuck in routine. So I think it's a win-win for both.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. And in the squad, you do have a lot of Belgian athletes, but you also have some international athletes. So what are some of the other nationalities you have in your squad?
Well, yeah, we have a good mixture now. So we have a German athlete like Jonas Schoenberg, who's training in Girona as well. Then we have some Spanish athletes who are regularly with the team. An Irish athlete, British athlete. I have to think a Dutch athlete. So it's like a bit of everything. So in general, the language is always English as well. I also speak some Spanish, which helps being in Girona because it's not easy to arrange stuff sometimes there and everything's a bit slow. So it really helps when you are working in Spain. So it's really an international squad, and I see it more and more develop like that. And yeah, it's both the level of the athletes is really rising, of course, recently, but also the mentality. I feel like really lucky to work with these athletes who are so motivated and going all in.
Yeah. And how many athletes do you have in the squad?
Well, it depends a bit of how you see. Like, sometimes I have athletes who I coach more abroad, and then sometimes join the squad for a camp or a longer period. So in general, it's between 10 to 15 athletes. Yeah, I mean, some athletes, it's just more like a more distance coached relationship.
Yeah. And what's the breakdown? Some of them are racing World Triathlon Championship Series. Some are more World Cup level, and some are more Continental Cup or under 23 juniors. What do you have a rough breakdown of the levels there?
Yeah, I think you covered it quite well. Some of them are doing like World Championship Series, some are doing World Cup, some European Cup. I have some juniors like who really, I who are maybe just below the level, like at the moment, to really be like good at European Cup level already. But they have some qualities in like maybe bike and run, just lacking the swim. So I really want them to give time for the swim because I really believe in a long-term approach. And I know they have like the values. Like if we look at the physiology, like we can really see they have like big potential. And I think the mindset is we're trying to go for gold, of course, also within the federation. And I think sometimes we are like looking on a too short term with these athletes. And if we can, for example, develop a swim over 3 years with one kind of athlete who has the potential to be the fastest runner, I think we should try to give him the opportunity and like steadily let him grow, even though he's not at the level now already where he should be to be racing at the European or World Cup level. So it's a bit of a mixture of everything, which makes it quite difficult for me as well, because there's like lots of different programs and it's almost every week a race for me. But I hope the squad develops to like everybody racing World Championship Series, of course, in the future, and that the coaches in Belgium can like really develop the young athletes to join the group in Girona with the international squad. That would be my dream to finish it up like that.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And you raise an interesting point there with some athletes that might not yet have the swim. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that you kind of see in some federations. Some federations are already moving past that. But in the talent ID process, a lot of federations in the past, at least I know, have had, you have to have a certain time for, let's say, 3,000 meters of running, exactly, and yeah, 1,000 meters of swimming or 400 meters of swimming. And mm-hmm. That kind of defeats the purpose of talent ID, because talent is not about how good you are right now, but or not only about that, but also about how good can you be in the future. So I think the way that you described that and looked at that makes a lot more sense than just purely looking at where the athlete is right now.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sometimes a hard discussion within the federation. And I also know the technical directors that need some cutoffs, but they're not working with the athletes, you know. And it's sometimes, yeah, we are observing things both mindset wise or like big improvements on a short term with athletes who are just not making the cutoff, so they don't get any funding and they're left behind, you know. So I have a good example of one athlete who was really short of the level, but he like kept on insisting, can I join you for a camp? And I said, yeah, okay, you can join once. Huh? And I got so impressed with his mindset, you know, like to do every night his exercises to improve mobility for the swim. And it gave me like, I saw potential there and I see him improving a lot. And it's like, it's more than just a cutoff time for a 3,000 meter run and a 400 meter swim, you know. And especially with that kind of young athletes, some of them are like late biologically mature. And like, it's something we have to keep an eye open for as a coach, I think.
Yeah, for sure. And can we discuss a little bit more about how the daily training environment works and in terms of the training itself a bit, what is a typical day like, but also what support structures do you have? Do you work with other physiotherapists? Of course, you have some expertise there yourself, and massage. What is it like for an athlete to be part of your squad?
Well, yeah, it's not only me, of course. It's like a big team of physiotherapists, nutrition, doctors, strength coaches. And I really like that. Like you said, I'm a physiotherapist from education, but I'm not touching the athletes anymore myself. I really want to keep that border and being a coach. Otherwise, there's always some problem you have to fix with an athlete. But like it's a team of a few physiotherapists who join for training camps, of course. And we have in Leuven and in Girona some physiotherapists who I can really like trust as well. I think it's very important as a coach. Sometimes you send an athlete to a physiotherapist and they come out of the session with like more questions or like they think have a big injury. So I really need to make sure the communication between the physiotherapist and the athletes is very good. And yeah, I now got a team of physiotherapists that I can really trust. Then I have some doctors like who do the blood checkups, and also when I have specific questions about altitude or like, for example, now, or about test results, I have some physiologists like Matthias Verstraal and Reinhard van Schuilenberg who work for the Belgian Federation who I can work with. And it's like, it's impossible for me to do everything. And that's like, I think one of my strengths, I realized that I cannot do everything. And I really try to surround myself with people who are like the best in their thing, so they can offer me the knowledge, and I try to get the puzzle together for them. So, and then I have my girlfriend who really supports me, and she's like digging really deep into the nutrition part of the athlete. So she's a nutritionist. For example, I just sent her your latest podcast about the hydrogels. And oh, yeah. She's like so passionate about it. So she's like making her own hydrogel now and testing things. And it's really cool. She can share that with the athletes, and I can share my point of view with her. And like, it's actually super fun to be part of now at the moment. And yeah, it's just an interesting journey of learning and improving all the time. So,
yeah. Yeah. And, how do you manage the, or how, let me rephrase the question. How important do you think that a good culture within a squad is? Is that something that you work actively on, having a certain values and a certain group dynamic in the squad? Can you talk a bit more about how that works?
Yeah, actually, that's really, really important to me. And like when we started the squad 5 years ago, it has been one of the basic principles that I founded the squad on. Like, I think there are a few important things that we can show vulnerability to each other. There's a lot of ego sometimes involved in the sport. And yeah, I think when we show our weaknesses, there's a lot of strength in it, and that we're not trying to prove ourselves too much and like really focus on improving. And I think it's a long-term process. It's not like this doesn't happen night over day. And it's like, yeah, having group talks, individual talks with the athletes, like, really confronting them with their weaknesses and with their insecurities, I think it's very important. And there's a few basic things that are like respect, honesty, who are always really important to me. And I think it's like when you build group vulnerability, I often make the comparison with like building a muscle. It takes time, repetition, and yeah, the willingness to suffer to achieve gains, you know. And sometimes I can be brutally honest with an athlete, you know, like, you're like, if I feel like you're not focusing on the right things, I am honest with them, and I don't want to waste time. My time is precious. And I think as well, like, I'm not helping them with like saying, hey, you're doing okay, just because they are talented, you know. And I think they need to focus on the right things. And yeah, especially being respectful to each other is very important. Over the years, I also saw like autonomy is for me one of the key principles as well. I want to have athletes when they go abroad and they are like, yeah, I'm not there to make the right decisions and to not rely on me all the time, to get insight in the training process and to make the right decisions when I'm not there as well. So it's one of the key principles as well.
So, yeah. Yeah. What about, is it important for athletes within the squad to be, you know, are they friends outside of training, hanging out and doing stuff like that? Or is that something that, you know, some maybe are, but some aren't? Is it like more like a workplace, you know, your colleagues, you're coming to training together and you go to some races together?
Yeah, to be honest, like, it's more like the friend thing, but it's not, of course, not everybody is like as close with everyone, of course. Yeah. Like, it's like really, it's not like split up in groups, but in general, I think how the squad evolved now is like everybody is genuinely like happy for another person if they are performing well. And that's like something I'm also proud of. Like, there is competition, of course, to get on start lists or to be the best at the championship, for example. But they will always feel like, okay, everybody did their effort to be on his or her best. And that's like valued in this group. And I think it makes it a strong group now at the moment. Like, they're really... and they really want each other to be happy and to perform well. So in general, it's really fun to go to sessions and to go there with a smile and see people smiling. So it's not always, of course, like that. We also have our bad days. So it's like somebody is tired and like a bit more grumpy, especially when you go 3 weeks on a training camp. You have to also know that people should be given their space, you know, and not if you're living together for 3 weeks with four athletes in a small building. Like, sometimes it's a bit suffocating, and yeah, it's something we need to talk about again. Then I think communication is like, hey, you're tired. Watch out with your reaction. Give each other space. And I think that's how you prevent them becoming like competitive or like really enemies in a way. So
yeah. Yeah. Well, you mentioned competition there, competition for places in or for qualifications and for results within races. How do you view or manage that within training? For example, is that something that you try to actively prevent people from competing with each other in training? And or yeah, how do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the main things we really like try to do in the group is intensity control. Yeah, and so we want to like really do everyone like is like doing their session at the right intensity. So I think now we're giving compliments to each other. Like if somebody hold down in the session, because like in the past it might have been like, oh, focusing on a time and you went so fast, and like people were giving credit to each other for that. But actually, it's just not like what's it about. I recently had an example of a young guy who like was in Girona training with the very elite then, like the more famous names, and he's actually a quite fast runner, and the guys were pushing a little bit harder than they should be doing at the moment, but he felt like he kept his intensity under control and just let them go without ego. And then it's like the mindset you really want to have in the group, like saying like, this is one my effort, I felt I was going above it. And was also even good for the high level athlete, because he's maybe one of the fastest runners, to see like, oh, this guy is like holding back and he's running so fast. So maybe, yeah, that's how we try to prevent the competition. And I think is by educating the athletes a lot as well. Like, why are we doing this? And what is your efforts? And if you have the testing, like from the athletes, from the physiological profile, and you can say like, you're building so much lactate, or you're going above threshold if you do it for such a long time, they get more insight and they get more confident to not do it, to not be competitive. It doesn't mean like at some point we're racing ITU, of course. And it also sometimes we need to push hard on training. And like in the final prep, I sometimes put them together, you know, and for example, for a chain ride in the bike. So it's if you're always doing your own intensity, it's also sometimes coming out of your comfort zone and like getting used to that surges that are not perfectly good for you. I think in the final phase, sometimes good to make them a bit competitive again as well, but in general they're really not competitive. So
And that already partially answers what was going to be my next question, which is about managing the individual aspects of training. So you're telling us then that they have individual targets based on testing. So do all of your athletes go through some sort of testing at the start of the season and maybe at some later point can you talk more about how you individualize the training and the targets?
Yeah. Most of them all do exercise testing. We use the Insight protocol most of the time. And I try to make it like, sometimes you don't have to do all the testing on one day. I want to make it like as less invasive for the athlete as possible. Sometimes I integrate it in a session. And if you want to have like the threshold part of the tests, I do it on one day where we do a threshold session and I take one block, I measure lactate, for example, in the beginning of the session. On the other day in a VO2 max session, I measure there like pre and post lactate and a VLA max test in a sprint session, for example. So we combine it like that so that the athlete doesn't feel like he's always going to the lab, you know? And so we get an individual profile out of that, and then And there are some general principles like building a big aerobic base who are the same for everyone, I think. And then we see like we have this much more anaerobic profiles, and we really like differentiate in training between different kind of profiles. And I think it's based on the testing, but also like on load tolerance, like injury proneness are very big important things in which we differentiate with the athletes. So it's really an individual approach within a group setting. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you do the testing in all three disciplines, in swimming, cycling, and running?
Yes, but not for all athletes in like swim, bike, run. We really try to focus on, we have some very good swimmers, for example, and like it's not like, I don't like it like as well, like to say like, oh, we're already a good swimmer, we cannot improve, you know, but if you're doing too much testing all the time with all the athletes, like it's also becomes a burden, and I don't want to get like a burnout of testing, you know, and it's sometimes easier to focus on one thing a bit more. And if they're really good in one thing, we leave that a little bit out. And we focus, for example, more on the bike and the run. But especially with the young athletes, we got a good profile of swim, bike, run, and see where we can make the most improvements in three disciplines. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you said there that about the profiling of athletes, with some being more aerobic or anaerobic. And that's an interesting question I always find to discuss how to approach those types of athletes differently in training. Can you describe how you do that, generally speaking?
Yeah, it's not always easy to really differentiate for that. For example, when we have like a very anaerobic profile, then we very early in the season, in the winter, already start much more tempo work, for example, or with interventions with nutrition, like doing more like in the fasting state, training. So it's actually one of the key things, and to just see like very early for a longer period of time doing consistently one thing to dampen that system, you know, and with combined with big gear work in the tempo, some short solid efforts combined with tempo work, like very early on in the season. And then we see, are we controlling that profile? Yeah. And can we go a bit more to like higher intensity VO2 max work or not? Because it's important to like keep on having a high VO2 max as well, and make sure the balance between the VO2 max and the VLA max, for example, is like a really like in the right regions, you know? So it starts quite early on. Let's say like if we do like a winter program, we have like in general, a 6 to 8 week base program where we do more like biomechanical like corrections, yeah, and like much basic aerobic base, but especially then with the anaerobic profiles, you see they're really going very high up in the VLA max, for example, and then we quickly start with softening that system.
Yeah. Mm, yeah, and the aerobic profile, how would that be different?
For the people for the with high VLA?
With a low VLA max and high or moderate VO2 max.
Yeah, so then we quickly integrate anaerobic capacity as well, doing more like short intensity work with long rest periods, for example. And it's really like, you see people with the high VO2 max, most of the time they can also tolerate like big volume. And we also do a bit more volume with them. It's based on muscle type fiber. Sometimes we have even testings from athletes who have like some kind of DNA testing profile as well, which is still like in his early footsteps, I think, and I don't rely completely on it. But you see like the athletes with a really big engine, most of the time they can really tolerate a lot of volume as well. And we, in the base period, we do more volume with these kind of athletes. Yeah. And then again, we measure like, are we doing too much or not? And when we go to a more like power phase, aerobic power phase, we see like that they're not too early in the season, too low in VLA max, for example.
Yeah. Mm, yeah. So you basically, with that type of athlete, if we're especially looking at somebody with a low VLA max, low anaerobic capacity, then you make sure that you don't want it to be too low either. You work on maybe even increasing it a bit. So
yeah, absolutely.
Find a sweet spot.
Yeah, especially in the beginning of the season, when they're doing a lot of races and more like I just said, more aerobic power, you can see it really go down steadily. So in the beginning of the season, we don't want to have it too low as well. And that's sometimes now an issue because many athletes are doing like 70.3 and like short distance, and then you have to see like the balance when they're going from one to another. It's high performance environment, so it's really, I also think sometimes we're like over focused on the numbers as well, and I want it to be within a certain range, of course, but like if I'm not panicking if like the VLA max is 0.1 or 2, maybe too low or too high, you know, like just focus on what we can control, I think, then, and direct the training in that direction and not say like, oh, we're already defeated because our VLA max is maybe 0.2 too high. Yeah. You know? So yeah, I think it's something I also learned as a coach to be critical to these values as well, of course. And like sometimes it's from day to day with an athlete, if you test them 1 week or 2 weeks later, you can have like completely different results based on their feeling and like the nutrition state, for example, all these kind of things. Always be critical and try to observe the athletes in every session, I would say, and see how they perform there as well.
Yeah, yeah. And at the end of the day, races are won on the race course and not in the lab. So.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned there how you do your kind of base phase and with focus on biomechanics as well. Maybe we can talk a little bit about your an overview of your coaching philosophy, if you will, and maybe we can start with kind of how you periodize the year for the squad, since you mentioned that initial base phase as well. So if you run through what a typical year might break down into the different periods.
Yeah, it's hard to say like for one athlete, because the differences in levels are so big now, and the season starts for some people much earlier than other people. In general, it's like I always work like with a big base phase. It can be longer for one athlete, depending on how long the winter is, of course. If they start early, it's always minimum 8 weeks, I think, also for neuromuscular adaptations and on the cardiovascular level. If we want adaptations, it's really like a minimum, I think. And then sometimes if the season starts early, we go more into like a specificer phase, not really specific, more like a build phase, where we do a bit more like already tempo work, big gear work, yeah. And then we switch to the specific phase, where we like really, yeah, go to the trying to meet the race demands based on the individual profile, of course. And I always like try to have like within the season, always like keep on repeating these phases as well, not make the specific phase too long, because the overall goal is always to like keep on improving over time. And if you like keep on going too long in too many races with too much specific work, yeah, you can just maybe hold on to your level and not keep on improving. And I think that's one of the basic philosophies, that sometimes in the season we have like a bigger period off again, and we repeat this base phase again, and to make sure we can keep on improving over time.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, and it's something I've been reflecting on quite a lot in my coaching as well. One of the hardest things, especially for athletes that do race quite a lot, to find the time to, or find the, well, find the courage almost to not keep doing specific training when there's always another race coming up. Like one aspect of it is, of course, planning your race calendar, but that's also depending on the athlete and the level they're racing at. The calendar is almost fixed with, for example, WTCS or World Cups or what have you. So yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that. And yeah, coming back to the, well, basically, because that's exactly what I've been thinking, that yeah, it's easy to get sucked into doing too much, too long race specific periods, but it doesn't really help you improve if you do it for that, for too much and too long.
No, absolutely. And I think many athletes associate their performance always with like the specific phase, you know, like with the few key sessions they did before their good result, you know. But actually, in my opinion, it's really all the work you did, the accumulated training load before, that allows you to do that key sessions right and to be able to perform then in the end. So without that phase, yeah, you're never going to hit the right numbers in the key sessions and to be really sharp for the when it really matters, I think. And I always tell them like to keep that in mind, the broad picture. And if an athlete, for example, needs to race a lot due to calendars, I really like sometimes use races as a specific session, you know, and not tapering for races, and see them as like key workouts within the season and to be really good at their A level race.
Yeah. And can you discuss a little bit about volume, how much volume your athletes are doing, and if it varies, which I assume it does, what does it depend on?
Well, yeah, it depends a little bit on the anaerobic profile versus aerobic profile, and the muscle fiber typology, I think, as well, I really look into. Also, boys versus girls, I am always a bit more careful with the girls, and do bit maybe especially for the run, I do a bit more strength work with the girls, I think, and a bit less volume, and make sure that I can keep on progressing in volume and intensity over time, not going too fast too soon. And volume wise, in general, I really believe in quite high volume, chronicle volume, like, and then taper off at the right moment. But that volume is like really different for like the older athletes versus the younger athletes. And if you want some numbers, for example, like
yes, please.
I was thinking, so like I think in general with the elites, we are like quite regularly around 30 hours a week, so very consistent in the build phase and the base phase. So it's quite a lot of volume, and it's divided maybe in 5 to 6 swims with 6 hour swim, and bike numbers up to 15 hours, running around 100k for the very elites. So, and it's always a bit individual, like some focus a little bit more on the swim, some a bit more on the run. I'm not really into like bike or run weeks. I try to keep it quite consistent in over time in all three disciplines, because I always think it's like always injury prevention wise also very interesting to not to have many big fluctuations in the volumes. And it helps to build like a big engine, I think, aerobically, and also like to have your loads really attenuated over time. I think it's very important. So
yeah. And what is, especially when you're in like a build phase or even a specific phase, how much intensity would you have in those weeks? Or do you have a typical like two hard swims, two hard bikes, two hard runs? Or is there any patterns like that you use in terms of the intensity?
Yeah, I think intensity wise, it's like in the run, you can say it's quite typical. We always do like two harder runs and the rest is like build up a volume around two specific sessions. So it's really not for athlete, never more than two hard runs. In the bike, I think now when we go like, for example, with Martin in the 70.3, we did a bit more emphasis on the bike. And maybe we did like three times like a bit more specific work on the bike, for example. And in the swim, I really like to keep the intensity quite high. That doesn't mean like it's brutal workouts, not at all. Let's say if you want to put it in numbers, we have like two specific workouts, but like even in regeneration sessions, we can do like little sprints to keep like the speed in. And so it can be like four workouts with a little bit of intensity in, but not like very brutal. It's not really fixed. Only our track Tuesday, maybe in the specific phase, like I think many athletes have like two fixed days for the run are quite fixed, but in general, it's really, not so determined in advance how many intensity we do in which discipline.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And what about recovery? Do you have any kind of down weeks, deload weeks, or do you work on a consistent schedule?
Yeah. So, but it is what you call a down week, of course. Huh? Like, it's always like the athletes who do like 30 hours a week on a regular base, then the down week might be 21, 22 hours, you know, and it's like still a lot for other athletes. And if I have young athletes who are doing like consistent 23 to 24 hours, then a down week might be 16 to 18 hours. But I like to keep the consistency in the three sports as well, even in the down weeks, just shorter sessions, not too long, maybe one complete rest day, not too many rest days in general. It's really depending on what is your basic volume in the other weeks. Yeah.
And how often do you have these down weeks?
Sometimes with young athletes, it's more in like a 2-1 ratio, but often with the elite athlete, it's more like a 3-1, like type of coordination of the down week. So it's like depending a bit on the level as well.
Yeah. And within a week, the micro cycle of a week, do you have a day or a couple of days that are lighter generally, or maybe a day that is just swimming?
So in general, like on an easy day, we do even a few sessions. So it could be like on a Monday after a bigger weekend, because sometimes it's easier for the non-professionals to do more work in the weekends. We do like an easy swim, and then it depends, like they do like a little jog and gym work. That's then the easy day. And then like for the other people, it might even be like swim, gym, and like do a 2-hour easy bike ride on an easy day. It's always looking at what the athlete really wants to do as well, I think, on these days. Some really like to ride their bike and they really get recovered mentally as well of doing a 2-hour coffee ride with friends. And then I also take that into account and look at the overall volume that we're not doing too much. And some people like to spread it a little bit more out. And sometimes I feel I have athletes, especially the more anaerobic athletes, sometimes they really need like a big afternoon off, or we just do an easy swim in the morning and that's it. And they get more recovered by doing completely nothing for maybe 20 hours, you know? So,
If we dive into the specific disciplines within triathlon a little bit, can you give some key fundamentals from your training process? And if we start with swimming, what are a couple of key points that you would give there?
Yeah, swimming, I think it's like the thing we differentiate the most in with the athletes. On a young age, I really try to get the biomechanics right. It's like some key things like body position in the water, strength, catch, of course, the basic things. And with the elites, like it's much more like getting the work done. So it's a really big difference there. And again, among three disciplines, it's always a consistency, you know, like I really like to be regularly in the water, not too much days without being in the water. And I prefer, I think it's a misconception sometimes that a bad swimmer needs to swim a lot. Because when the technique is not right, you're just like promoting the bad technique all the time. So I like to have them like for shorter sessions in the pool and maybe do, for example, 6 sessions, but with good quality. And I think it's a mistake many coaches do, like me, maybe in the past as well. Like I throw a lot of volume on there because we need to swim a lot, but actually the swimmer is just getting worse and worse. So it's actually like, really see how the technique is for the swim. So it's really important. And then specific to open water, we do a lot of strength work. With pool boy pedals and also band work, so or with propeller, depends on the stroke dynamics as well. Like you see, like how we can convert a stroke to a more open water stroke. If, like for example, the frequency is really low, we really focus on that because sometimes we have very good pool swimmers who come out of the water like in a place that you would never expect them, and then we know it's not like the VO2 max, for example, but it's more like the stroke dynamics that we need to change. So in the swim, it can be quite different from athlete to athlete, but consistency is like the main principle again in all athletes.
Yeah. So digging into that one detail there about the stroke rate, because that's something I think that a lot of age groupers as well have that problem of having too low a stroke rate.
Yeah.
And what are some tips, some exercises or sets that you would recommend for working on improving your stroke rate or increasing your stroke rate?
Yeah, I really like to get them aware of where, especially like using video images, like as well, to see like the coordination of their two hands, like if they are really swimming in catch up, and like to show them like, hey, this is your stroke and this is not efficient in open water. And then like, for example, using the tempo trainer in the pool can be really useful with a certain frequency. You let it hear to them like on their natural frequency, and you always improve it, increase it. And then you see like, you show them the video again, how the stroke is changing, and you try to find a sweet spot in the beginning, because if you do it too high, they're just like not grabbing any water. What I really like is like these short builds, you know, you do like over 50 meters. If you have a 50 meter pool and you like build the frequency steadily, and then maybe you hold it for 50 meters and not make the fractions too long in the beginning. It's like running with a higher cadence in the beginning. It's like can be really strange for an athlete. I feel like my heart rate is higher now. So it's really, and I think it's not efficient, but your body needs to adapt. And if you want to do it like one long set, high frequency, you're just going to promote a bad technique again and make them very tired. So it's like really building it gradually, I think. And you have some tools like a propeller and a band who are forcing you automatically to not swim, catch up. That can be really good. But of course, it can also be too hard. And if the body position is like really bad with these tools, then you have to figure out if it's already the right time or not to use them.
All right. And then biking, what are some key fundamentals there?
Well, I have a biking background, and I'm a big believer of doing a steady volume on the bike, a lot of base work, and then we really look at the individual profile. It's some people really like the peak powers. We focus a bit more on that because in ITU racing, for example, I think the anaerobic speed reserve is quite important as well. If you're always close to your limit of your maximum peak powers with all the cornering, it can be much more demanding for your energy system there. So, And it's really periodized. For example, one period we do more VO2 max work, for example, in the build phase, if we see the profile is ready for it. And then like to the specific phase, we go more to like threshold efforts on the bike, longer efforts. But again, it can be different. Like I explained earlier with the anaerobic profile, we go earlier into tempo zone or threshold work, and then maybe later into a bit more higher intensity work. So, And some other things like cadence work as well, like to get improved pedal efficiency. Some short sprints can be important. I think short sprints in a base phase are always good to like get some neuromuscular adaptations there as well, and not losing the speed when you're doing a lot of base work. So it's a bit of everything, but on the right time.
And the anaerobic speed reserve, that's interesting that you mentioned that. Do you think that the anaerobic speed reserve is more important to have quite well developed on the bike than in the run in ITU racing, or do you think they're equally important?
No, I think it's more important on the bike than on the run because it's much more staccato, demanding for the athlete. So in the run, it's more like running a steady pace, and you need like to have a surge sometimes, of course, but it's not continuously surging and dropping down. So I think it's much more important on the bike. And I think, especially towards Olympic distance, having a very high lactate threshold, LT2, anaerobic threshold, whatever you want to call it, is like a key determinant of your performance. So, and much less the anaerobic speed reserve.
Yeah, and in an Olympic distance, especially when it's a relatively long race, then by the time you get to the run, you will have depleted yourself so much that your anaerobic speed reserve is completely different than it was if you did a fresh 10K. So
exactly,
it doesn't matter as much. Yeah. No, that was what I was thinking, but it was interesting to hear what you think as well. What about running? What are some key fundamentals there?
Proper run technique without like overanalyzing. I think you have people who are used to running in a certain way as well, and you try to optimize that. So at the beginning, I was like really into run biomechanics because my physiotherapy background, and it was my own weaker discipline. So I really tried to figure it out, maybe overanalyze as well. So I wanted to make everybody run beautiful. I think now it's less that, and I want to make sure key principles are good. And I think like we really differentiate a lot in volume with the run. Like some people are really like prone to injury, for example, and we do like 50-60 Ks a week maximum, and I think we can have like huge improvements. I think sometimes athletes are so focused on the mileage. And with doing like a bit less volume and doing right strength work or activation before sets, we can keep them like injury free and to really like get the most out of every session, which is the most important in my eyes. And we do some analysis of plyometric strength, combined with the physiological profile, where we determine how we approach the run. And I think it's, of course, it's always the key determinant. Maybe it's a cliche. You cannot like win the race in the swim, but you lose the race, but you win the race in the run. So it's a very important one to find how you can really increase your speed at threshold. And it's different for everyone. It can be by increasing your VLMX or increasing VO2 max, and you have to find out what's important for which athletes on the right time. So
What plyometric tests are you doing, and how do you use that information?
We use actually simple tests that we can repeat quite often. So it's like with the push device, where we do like repetitive jumps or drop jumps, and we measure like the reactive speed. And then we can see if we go to a next phase as well. I like to have like these like cutoffs where I can see we do a bit more of plyometric work if they're not very low. If they're very low in the repetitive strength index, like we really want to like first focus on strength and then go a bit more to plyometrics. If they're already quite good values for the plyometrics, then we increase the box jump height, for example, the drop jump height, and we go a bit more advanced into that. So it's really looking at stride as well, for example, evaluating ground contact times under fatigue and see what we do there. So it's a bit of putting all the data together, especially for myself, and not like to burden the athlete too much with it, and then see how we adapt it into the training.
Do you do, at least with those athletes that may have a weakness in those assessments, do you do a lot of plyometric work as part of your kind of strength work, or even pre or post run?
Both, actually. Like if we see it's weak, we try to keep it 2 times a week in the strength program. If we see they're weak, and sometimes it's also with biomechanical adaptations. If like some people are lengthening out their stride too long, we try to like really focus on a quick heel return and like keeping the, like do a little activation before the run, and then like do a few hundred meter strides in advance, show them videos as well, show them data like of like how is it changing when you do what, and then try to keep them in the real set aware of what they've been changing and to like focus on what we're trying to change. I think the pre-activation is really important, actually. Like doing a few drills in advance can really help athletes to get that feeling and to get get naturally into their strides without overthinking, you know?
Yeah. So, And one other follow-up question on the run was regarding, you mentioned proper run technique, but without over-analyzing things. But are there a couple of things that you would say are, yeah, these are things that you see with some athletes that always need to be correct? Like, do you have a couple of examples of things that you would correct?
Yeah, for sure. I think one main thing I always like, the hip drop is something I always think, like, you lose a lot of energy there if your pelvis is not stable and you're really like letting one, if you hit the ground, your pelvis is dropping on the other side. I think that's one thing I really always want to correct, for example. Yeah, because it's both injury prevention and efficiency, I think. Two in one, you really want to improve on. And if that is really bad on their fatigue, I let them run less and try to focus on keeping that right. There are other things, for example, like arm swing. Sometimes people have like an ugly arm swing, but everything is stable in the core and the glutes, for example. Then I don't overemphasize on the arm swing, for example, and just try to make them a little bit aware of it without saying you have to run perfect with your arms. If we see the arms are a consequence of something else in the chain, then of course we try to correct it, but most of the time it's coming from somewhere else then. So it's looking what's really important for the stride or not.
When a new athlete joins the squad, are there some things that you kind of and you start observing them and coaching them, what are some things that you find that these are some common mistakes that athletes are doing and that you see and that get corrected when they join? Do you have some examples of that?
Yeah, I think the main issue is often that they want to prove themselves when they come into the squad and they want to show their qualities. And like, it's quickly that they realize that it's not what the squad is about, you know, and it's focused on improving and the process on the longer term. I try to have conversations with the athletes immediately. Like, I really want them to trust the process. It's very important. And I think that's where educating the athlete is important, how we approach things within their own profile and why some people need to back off in some sessions and some other not. I really want them to know why it is. Yeah. Otherwise, they keep on making that mistake. So, yeah, the proving thing is always difficult in the beginning, I think. And then the showing vulnerability, I think, I sometimes have athletes who are really trying to hide a little injury or something, you know, because they see it as a sign of weakness. And they think like, oh, yeah, I have to do this session and be with the group, or they think like I'm not good enough. And in the end, you're really lying to yourself and you're getting further away from your goals. And I think I really like it when an athlete can come in the group, because it's hard. You're doing the warm-up, you feel a niggle, and they come before the set and they can tell me, I think it's better not to do the set because I feel this or that. Yeah, you gain a lot more out of that than trying to push through and be injured afterwards. And it's sometimes hard, especially with the boys. Sometimes they like to have the hard sessions and the grind together, but it's something we try to get out of and like really focus on communication and like, yeah, that thing is very important.
Yeah. And
combined with the generation, like the young generation, it's like always instant gratification, I think. And they really want to see short-term results, and in endurance sports, I don't believe in that. So it's like really a long-term process, and yeah, they need to be patient, I think. And that's something with the younger generation sometimes quite difficult.
Yeah. One thing that we've talked about quite a bit already is you're doing testing and you're being specific with training targets and so on. And but in general, in terms of how you're using science and technology in the training process, are there any things that we haven't really talked about that you would like to mention? For example, do you do lactate testing generally regularly in the field in training as well, or any other tools that you use for monitoring, or anything like that would be interesting for the listeners to hear about?
Yeah, there are a few things. I think the lactate testing in the pool, it's quite clear, of course. We always do it in the pool when we do it for the swim. But like I said, I always was critical in the beginning, and also with the testing in the swim, like even 5 years ago, with like the swim testing in the federation, I realized that some values were really off in the swim. Like I said, like this guy is like much higher aerobic capacity than we think, you know, and, or is coming out of the test results. So I had with some colleagues VO2 master to compare the results coming out of the lactate tests and the VO2 master then. And we can find huge differences because of economy and efficiency of the athlete, you know. So it's something, a test result is one thing, but always know what you're testing and what is influencing the test result. So with a high-level athlete with good efficiency, it's much more reliable, I think. In the run, the differences are closer. On the bike, it's much more reliable, so you can be more like trustworthy there. So, yeah, I think it's being critical. It's very important to interpret the results. And then on the bike, I like to do them like in the field. So, but it always has to be specific, you know. If it's like TT, make sure it's on the TT. If you're doing a flat course, make sure it's on a flat course. If you have to do a hilly ride, and it's the most important part for a cyclist, is uphill. Do the testing uphill to know what you should be pushing on a longer hill. I think always think of like specific to your race demands. I think that's a mistake we sometimes make. We use tests for one thing to interpret, for example, a long distance course. They go on the road bike and they do a lap test, and you know, the TT bike, they can push much less power and being like much more like higher in lactate than they should be for the same power output. And it's something like, that's how we use science. And it's also by measuring a lot in the field. I think that's where we really differentiate in sets. Like, and some days it means like we have to back off, you know, and that's it, and we accept it. But I think that's the a very important aspect of our training methodology. So yeah, and then maybe other tools that we use. HRV is an important one, getting more important, I think, to monitor the athletes. I really like it because it can be an objective parameter for the athletes without getting the feelings too much involved. Like, they always say that they can train, you know, the high level athletes, they always say, yeah, I'm ready to go. But then you can have some really good data and saying, look, it's already a few days that your variation is like quite high or you're trending down, and maybe something is wrong combined with, can be other things, elevated heart rate in the morning. And these basic things are important, combined with the observation of the coach, still very important. I remember my first congress in Paris, I think, where Steven Seiler was speaking, and he said, like, in the morning, if you see the hats in the bowls, it's always like one of you when they're at the breakfast table and everybody's head is hanging down, like, it's so maybe you're pushing it too far. And yeah, it's a combination of these two parameters of observing your athletes combined with the tools that are available now. I think it's you have to make an educated guess. I think that's important.
Are there any trends in science or technology in sport that you maybe have tried but have not liked for one reason or another, that you think are not so useful?
Yeah, it's hard because I don't want to kick against some big brands or something. Like, it's like really the Super Sapiens, I'm not really convinced yet, for example. I've been using it with some athletes, and sometimes I find it reliable. And I think it can be also, it's backed up by science, I think. During exercise, sometimes it's not really reliable. And I also find sometimes it's not working well with athletes, and it's becoming a hassle to work with it. So it's something I think there is something to learn there for sure. And if it works well, then I think that's one of the main issues with it. Like, the reliability is not always good. There's definitely something to learn there. But in general, we can use it still for see the influence of breakfast, for example, on your glucose in the first 3 hours when you're not. It's good for an athlete. I just had a discussion with one of my colleagues, actually, that he said, like, but you can just send them an article that if you eat proteins combined with carbohydrates, that it's like better for their blood sugar not to spike and to go immediately down again before a session. I said, like, yeah, but it doesn't work like that with an athlete. So if an athlete sees it, experiments with it, like, then it's still an additional value for the athlete, I think. Because if we send scientific articles to the athletes, it's not always the best way to handle it. So so it's something I'm not completely against, but something I find like not being very reliable during my time using it, for example.
One thing that I also want to discuss is Martin Van Riel recently set the world best Ironman swim three time. I don't know if it's called the world best or world record, but it was a really fast race anyway, and a really good performance. But can you discuss similarities and differences in his training for that race for Sim 3 Dubai compared to his normal training for short course racing?
Yeah. Maybe good to know is that like the main goal has always been to like keep on performing on short distance. So it was something like Martin really motivated and wanted to do, 70.3 in the beginning of the season, because the season starts quite late as well. And it was, we only decided actually half of January, because end of December we started to work together, and he already had the base work done with a lot of the base work done with Joel, a coach who I really like look up to as well, and who I think I have many similarities with in my approach of the athletes. So but then we decided to do 70.3, and the things we really, like, first thing we had to do was get the position on the TT bike, right? I think it was only 1 month out, so we had 4 weeks of really training on the TT bike. We did like a good bike fit, and we quickly accepted like the things we could control or not, and not going into the wind tunnel or going to like just use our common sense of where we could get like aero gains and hold the position for a longer time. That was already one step of the process, of course, where we changed the bike, going to the TT bike. And then, yeah, we did some testing, of course, like I said, like with Insights, we did like a few tests, and we saw like, of course, what's normal after the base period and short distance athlete, like his anaerobic profile is a bit too high to be like really very good on the longer course. We tried to soften it out a little bit, doing much more tempo work. So if you would say the big difference was going from more polarized to more pyramidal training, doing much more zone 3 work, and also big gear work, muscle endurance. I think that was like the biggest change in his training program in that period. So combined with doing sets maybe a bit later in the session after a certain amount of kilojoules spent, make sure he could do it for a longer time, the efforts. And I think on the bike especially was a big difference on the run. We skipped the VO2 max work a little bit in that phase because he already has quite a high VO2 max naturally. And so we did really try to get his anaerobic threshold as close to his VO2 max, did a lot of LT2 work and longer tempo work near the final phase. And actually, I think the biggest gain we had was like always controlling these sessions. Like when we started our reps, like 3Ks, and we measured lactate, okay, we're right where we want to be. We had the testing. We knew where we had to be. And we always hit the right intensity every session. I think it was strange for Martin as well, sometimes holding back, I think, you know, like, when the result is that good, of course, you get trust in the process, and it feels good afterwards, of course.
Yeah. Can you give an example of a key tempo workout on the bike and a key strength endurance workout on the bike that you did, since you mentioned those two as kind of key parts of the bike
Yeah. So on the bike, I think what we did quite early was some solid spikes, really high intensity. Like for example, 3 times 45 seconds high intensity, and then followed with a good short rest, very easy. And then we did a long tempo part where we did like 3 minutes low cadence and then a longer period at the same power output, but high cadence, the cadence that he had to push in the race as well. So, and this like several times in a session. And then towards the end, it went more to longer fractions of tempo work, where we did like, for example, one of the key sessions, I think, was 4 times 25 minutes tempo zone, just very simple, you know. Yeah. And like, I think also we don't have to make it too fancy all the time. You have to know what's the goal of your session and why you're doing it. And like, if you look at the parameters you have from the testing, you know, what you should be doing, and try to prolong it. And we got a lot of confidence about measuring things, I think. So even if we did like this long intervals and we see the powers he was pushing, and then we saw the lactate was like really where we wanted to be, it's not higher. It was like also for me, because I was thinking, are we doing too much? You know, like sometimes is it too much power because he's not super heavy, you know, and can he hold this for a long time? But then you get like confirmation by the values, and that gave us a lot of confidence going into the race, you know. And I actually the race plan was executed quite well, and like it was almost like we knew it could happen this way, and it happened that way. It was very fun to experience, of course.
Yeah. And on the run, if what would an example be of a key LT2 run? Like how long intervals and how many intervals, just to get an idea of what that
is? Yeah, I have to look back into the data actually, because it's been a while already. I think one of the key sessions we did was few times, I think 3 times 2 mile, and then 5 times 1 mile. Yeah, all So if you put it in case, it's like around 3Ks and then like 1600 meters. So actually, that was one of the key sessions we did, and it was actually always like trying to prolong the time at LT2. We didn't want to like increase the speed too much, but we always wanted to try increase the time and longer fractions, and maybe near the very end we just skipped the real LT2 work again and we went to like longer tempos even, around race pace, very specific.
Then a couple of more questions just general regarding coaching and triathlon. First, what are some things that have changed in your coaching since, I think, 2018 when you started the squad? Do you have any examples of something that you do differently now than you did back then?
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm always changing. The world is always changing. So I think we need to be flexible and always question ourselves. I think the main thing that's changed is due to COVID as well. Like I found myself often, I think, when I had a talented athlete, like trying to sometimes me wanting it more than the athlete, you know, like I really afraid to lose the athlete or whatever, and not being like completely honest with the athlete or trying to make everything work for the athlete. And then I saw actually with COVID was a big eye opener that like, if you're not really passionate about the sport and love showing up for sessions every day, even without races being available, on the long term, it's a very important factor. And I didn't want it anymore for the athlete. I want to have my athletes like coming to the session and wanting to work together, improve, and not focusing only on the result. And I think that sometimes in the past, I was always focused too much on the results as well. And also maybe took some pride in having good performances with athletes. And now I take much more pride in like working together to a big goal and enjoying the process. And I know the results will follow then. I think that's something I really switched mindset in over the past years.
How do you think, or do you think triathlon has changed and or is changing in the last few years and will change in the coming years?
I think it changed a lot because in general the level is rising quite high. Like it's really insane if you look at the results of the past years. Also for young athletes, it's like a big issue. Like they come from juniors to under 23, the fields are quite stacked, and like we're losing a lot of talent, I think, because there are not many under 23 races where they can like race against their fellow age level athletes, you know. So it's really they need to be like very good on a very young age or they get dropped out, I think. So it's really an issue we need to think about. Even with World Triathlon, I think it's something we maybe have to think about, providing more under 23 races. And where I see the biggest difference is, I think, on the bike, where in the past, like the swim and run was like very like important factor for the result, and the bike could be a little bit less. And I think that in these days, it's like impossible. And if you look at the bike powers of World Cup level, even like not even WTS level, it's like increased a lot over the past years, and you cannot have any weakness anymore. And it's a good thing, of course. It makes it like super interesting as a coach that you have to be good in the three disciplines. And sometimes you can get away with it. Huh? It's like there's always a race where it's like a pack, and it's very hard to do a breakaway, and it's a very easy bike, and you can have a weird result sometimes. But in general, the bike is getting so fast as well; it's a big difference. So, and then what I also think is with all the different formats, with Super League coming, and then the short distance athletes being interested in 70.3, I think it's also a danger that like everybody wants to do everything, and it's like we were discussing earlier, like if you want to keep on improving, if you're only doing racing, yeah, you will stay at one level and you can be good for 1 year maybe, but then the year after you will like not keep being able to keep on improving. So it's really important to make right choices. And maybe for example, Super League and World Triathlon already working together a little bit, and I think it's a good thing. And it should keep on thinking about how to develop the calendars. And also, like for now, the season, the final is end of November. And if athletes are racing from January, it's like there's almost no off season anymore. And I think also it's something important to think about for the health of the athletes and to keep it sustainable for a longer period of time.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And the final question before the rapid fire questions is for age group triathletes listening, can you give 1 to 3 key pieces of advice that might help them improve their performance?
Yeah, probably they've been said like a million times on your podcast. So it's coming back to the same, I think, consistency. And don't be afraid to let one workout, if you don't feel good or feel a bit injured, to cancel the workout or maybe do it a day later, and find the balance with the life stress, which is really important. And many times underestimated, I think. So if you have problems at home or not feeling good, it might be good to contact your coach and to say, hey, can I do this session a day later? Or what do you think? And yeah, like this, we also come to the second point, like work with an experienced coach. I think it's it helps you make the right decisions and prevents you making mistakes. So it's really important. So work with a coach and then just get out. Don't overthink. I think sometimes we are really like, can I do this or can I do not? Just lace up your shoes and go out and see how it feels. Trust your feeling. Try to connect with your feeling as well. Like I've been talking a lot about lactate testing and intensity control, but actually one of the key fundamentals of the group is as well to link your RPE with a certain kind of effort. I think that's very important because we're not always there with the device. And if I say tempo zone, for example, the athletes know they need to be RPE 6-7 and try to control that. And if they're doing it on a headwind or in a hilly surface, I want them to know to not look at a pace or not look at, it's not always available. Of course, on the bike, it's easier, but to really know what they should be doing that session. I think that's very important for an athlete, not just blindly follow numbers.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense, of course. And let's move on to the rapid fire questions. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to triathlon or endurance sports?
Maybe not directly related to triathlon. A book I really like, and the psychologist I work with will laugh that I mentioned it again. It's Anti-Fragile from Nassim Taleb. It's a book where they talk about like how to overcome like setbacks to become better. And you have the difference between being robust and anti-fragile. And I think like material, they can, if you do put it under stress, it can like keep its same form and keep its same strength, but doesn't improve. And I think as an athlete, there will be setbacks always. I haven't seen a high level athlete who didn't have setbacks. So I think you have to learn from it, get better from it. He makes a comparison, for example, with a tsunami. Like you can always say, oh, there a tsunami path and like the complete destruction or whatever, but you cannot prepare. You cannot know when the tsunami is coming, but you can prepare yourself to be as resilient as possible for the tsunami and to get better after what happened. So I think it's really a book that opened my eyes because it was so relatable to many fields, not only sports, but like medicine, economy. I was like quite impressed with the book when I first read it. So
And it's been recommended before. So it's good that the really good resources they keep coming up kind of get a picture of what you should be reading.
I have to warn you, I'm reading it, I think, already for the third or fourth time now, I think. And it's always like hard to... He's a very intelligent person. I used to think I was intelligent, but when I see how many broad interests he has, and like it's quite amazing to read it and to see like how he built up the book. And I'm really fascinated by the book. So, cool.
Yeah. And then, what's an important habit that you have benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
I think in the beginning, I was like narrow-minded, that sports was the most important thing in my life, I think. And it's still like, I'm super passionate about sport. I wake up with it and I go to sleep with it. But I also know, like, I want to my athletes and myself to know there's many more things happening in life. And to if we have a bad day at a session, I think it's always like, it's only a bad day at a training session, and there are people suffering in other places much more. And I want to put it in perspective and focus on the efforts that we're doing, growing together. And yeah, combined with taking time off, I think it's something I sometimes suffer with as well. And I think it's very important. So I try to keep my daily run, for example, even if it's like 20 minutes to clear my head, because I think I can only perform well and be creative again for writing schedules when I think of myself as well. And I think it's sometimes we sometimes forget and we just get caught up in work too much.
Yeah, that's a bit of an occupational hazard, I think. So really important to think about. And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I already mentioned Joel Filial, I think. He's like a coach I could quickly relate to, the way he approached building a group. And also building an athlete, like on the both on the physiological level and also on the tactical level, and I'm really inspired by him. But sometimes it's also like people very close to me. I have one very good friend. He's like a biologist, and we come from all both of us like from a small town. And yeah, he quickly went full in for his hobby. What it was like that, he made a profession out of his hobby, and he traveled the world. He lived abroad in New Zealand, Canada. And he was living his dream, and I think it opened my eyes as well. And he was always happy, smiling, and when we saw each other, so he really inspired me, like without even knowing it, I think. So.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. And Joel Filial is, as you probably know, a past guest on the podcast. So for the listeners that haven't listened already, highly recommended. I'll put the link in the show notes so that you can check it out. And Glenn, finally, where can listeners find you or follow you and your squad and what you're up to?
Yeah, well, we have a website, but I have to admit it's not really up to date, and we should put more work into it. I think the best way to follow us is on Instagram, where we have an account. It's called PTC Coaching, and if you want to, you can always send a direct message through the account, and I will try to respond as quickly as possible. And also there, time-wise, it's sometimes difficult to keep up with all the races, and I try to keep it a little bit up to date, so yeah.
Great.
Things to improve on for the future.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been really awesome. I think, tons of information. Really great to get some insight into how you work and lots of things to think about from this one for sure. So thank you for taking the time.
Thank you very much. It was great being on the podcast.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com and links to Glenn's website and Instagram, or the PTC Coaching website and Instagram, that is. If you want to improve your triathlon performance and want help to achieve your goals, then I would highly recommend reaching out to us at Scientific Triathlon to discuss regarding getting a coach or a training plan. Whether you're just getting into triathlon or trying to qualify for a world championship event or even want to race professionally, we have experience in all of those scenarios and we'd love to discuss further around if and how we can help you on your triathlon journey. Find out more and contact us on scientifictriathlon.com and we can discuss your specific goals and needs and see what option is best for you. Big thanks finally to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free online sweat test and quick carb calculator to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs, and individualize your plan with a free video consultation with the team at Precision Fuel and Hydration. Use the code TTS22 at checkout for 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, and exceptional sunglasses and prescription glasses for everything from day-to-day wear to extreme action sports. Use the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS to get 20% off your entire Roka order. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.